Transition, talk show podcast with Rex and Lav. Wyndham Clark is the winner of the 126th U.S. Open. But Rex, that does not do justice what we witnessed in the final round at Shinnecock. There was drama. There was controversy. There was poor crowd behavior. There were heroic shots. There were mind-bogglingly bad shots. I mean, what did we just witness as Wyndham Clark, now a two-time U.S. Open champion?
There were clutch shots. I think that's what I'm going to come back to. Every single time Wyndham Clark needed to make a putt, he did. We'll go through the card in a minute because I know that's what you absolutely love to do. But this is what you have to do to win major championships. And I think the person that we anticipated that from, probably Scottie Scheffler going into this final round, couldn't do it. The one that has done it before, though, the one that's won the U.S. Open just a few years ago at LACC, was able to pull it off. You're right. I'm a little mixed on this one. I have sort of mixed feelings because I think Wyndham Clark sort of emerged in my mind as a player, a world-class player, to be able to do this for the second time. However, what we saw from the crowds, what we saw from him over the course of the week, it was hard to digest because there's so many mixed messages in there. He is truly a likable figure, and yet somehow in the public consciousness, he comes across as this villain. I don't quite understand that, but the performance itself on what was a really cool golf course, and it was set up in a very well-mannered way. Clearly the USGA should get a win on this one because they could have let this one get away from them. I think you're absolutely right. Seven strokes up going into the final round. This could have been a snoozer, and it wasn't. It was very exciting.
We had a colleague who texted us right about 6:30 p.m. Eastern local time here in Long Island. And she said, and we're not going to name her, she said that was a boring final round. What a snoozer of a final round. I could not disagree any more wholeheartedly. I thought it was tense from the opening bell, because Rex, you had either two scenarios. Either Wyndham Clark was going to win in what we all knew was going to be an antagonistic atmosphere, or you were going to have an incredible historic collapse slash comeback, which we almost had as well. So we had two things going on at once, and you had Wyndham Clark coming back to the field. You had Sam Burns, among others, making a run at him to challenge for the title. I thought it was compelling. I thought it was taut. I thought it was tense. I thought it was dramatic all the way from the opening bell, where, again, Wyndham Clark is going to the opening tee and he's hearing barbs like Canada hates you. And when his tee ball is in the air, get into the bunker, dive into the fescue. No one's rooting for you. No one likes you. And it continued for 4.5 hours until he finally was able to tap in the one footer. I thought from beginning to end, this was as tense, as pressurized an atmosphere as you could possibly have for a major championship.
Okay, let's chop this up because we're doing a really bad job of breaking this out into the different storylines, because I think the crowd is a much
different story. Let's focus on the atmosphere, because I thought that was story 1A on Sunday.
I tend to agree. First and foremost, I want you to name names. Who was this colleague? I want to know names.
Hello,
right,
Russ.
Now.
Russ, this was all on you.
Such a thing. In her defense, in her humble defense, I will say, coming down the stretch, there was a window, which I think she sent this text message, where Wyndham was up 3 strokes, and I think it was 4 or 5 holes to play. And at that point, you think he's going to hold on to this. He's going to finish in a dominant fashion because he had done it all week long. You and I talked about this on the Saturday Night Podcast going into the final round. There was nothing in his body of work over the course of three days on this golf course that suggested he was ready to implode. I think both of us pointed out that on Saturday he only hit half his fairways, that he led the field in putting, that he was making all of these big putts when he absolutely had to. But you look at how he finished statistically. Yes, he finished fourth for the week in strokes gained putting. That was a key stat. He made some huge putts coming down the stretch. On number 4, he made a 15-footer. On number 6, he made a 10-footer. On number 16, he made a 20-footer. I would argue two-putting the 18th hole from 52 feet was probably one of the gutsiest things I saw out of him all week long. But he also hit the ball pretty well, and I think that's going to get glossed over because of how good his short game. Even Scottie Scheffler, who was paired with him in the final round, said, look, he's sneaky good around the greens. And we saw that time and time again. Every time he put himself in a situation where you thought, yep, this is going to lead to a big number, it's going to be a bogey, he's going to struggle to even make that, he found a way to just keep his lead. He found a way to always stay ahead. I think you and I scribbled down the same thing because it came up on the TV at the same time. He held the solo lead by himself from 7:09 p.m. on Thursday all the way through to the end. That's so difficult to do.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of people are going to point to a couple specific windows of time that Wyndham Clark won this golf tournament. You go back to Thursday. Remember, you had the two-hour fog delay, so Wyndham Clark finished late into the night on Thursday, had to come back on Friday morning. But late on Thursday night, when the wind really died down, he went birdie, birdie, eagle on holes 3 through 5, a 4-under in a 3-hole span to jump out to 6-under. At that point, 2-under, 68, was the best round in the clubhouse. At that point then, Rex, the following 36-odd holes, he really won the golf tournament with his scrambling. And I think in particular that third round on Saturday, when even though it added up to an even par 70, the number of saves that he made and the up and downs that he made, I'm thinking most pertinently on number 10, getting up and down over the back when he had a really brave, confident bump into the bank, ended up getting up and down from a position in which a lot of the players, most of the players who were in that position, were either making bogey or double. Did the same thing on 11, finishing the greenside bunker short and right, skied it out to about 10 feet and hold that putt as well. So his sort of clutch up and downs coincided with a time when a lot of his fellow playing competitors were making bogeys. For the week, at that point, he was first in the field in scrambling. He was 7 of 9 on Saturday. It was eerily reminiscent, in my opinion. This was one of the first tournaments that I really remember paying attention to, was Retief Goosen, the 2004 U.S. Open, coincidentally, at Shinnecock. And if you remember in that final round, he had 11 one-putt greens, including one putting his final 6 holes. That's, to me, what it felt like Wyndham Clark on Saturday. He was continually out of position. He was continually missing greens. He was continually hitting shots that were frustrating him, particularly with his wedges. And yet each and every time it seemed, it didn't happen, but every time it seemed like he could escape. That is why he was able to build the 6-shot cushion. And obviously he needed every single stroke as it came down on Sunday.
And I think it's a really good point that you point out on Thursday, and it seems like a year ago now, so much has happened since then. But even Sam Burns brought this up in his interview, that 2-hour fog delay made all the difference in the world, really, in the final outcome. And very rarely do we go back to Thursday at a major championship and talk about how influential that was. It's because it pretty much set everything back for the entire week, or at least for the first 2 rounds. It also altered the golf course dramatically. We're going to talk about the idea that the USGA came into this with kid gloves. They wanted to make sure that this golf course didn't get away from them like it had the last 2 US Opens that had played here. So it was on the softer side even to begin the week. And then when you show up Thursday morning, really before sunrise, and you've already got this fog layer and the moisture is staying in the ground. And I know that's a boring topic, but it was a big part
of this week.
It's a very boring topic, but it was such a big part of this week because even through Sunday, I saw shots stopping on greens that back in 2018, we did not see those shots stop. Back in 2004, we didn't see those shots stop. Even from a visual, when you saw the overhead shot and you could kind of see sometimes out of the corner, National Golf Links, which is right next door. National Golf Links had that yellowish hue that we're used to seeing from these types of golf courses this kind of year. Shinnecock Hills looked green. It looked lush. And that was by design. The USGA wanted to make sure this didn't get away from them. And you're right. That allowed Wyndham Clark late in the afternoon on Thursday to make that run and separate himself. Scottie Scheffler talked about the difference this week is, once again, and we're going to get into Scottie, he got off to a slow start and he spotted Wyndham in the first round 9 strokes, if I'm doing the math correctly on that one. And that's clearly the difference in this outcome. I'll also point out the forecast was pretty much wrong all week long. And it always seemed to
be tough week for Thorgard.
Yes, not a great week for Thorgard. I think you guys need to do better next time around. I'm looking forward to seeing you next year at Pebble. That one's going to be tough as well. But it seemed to benefit Wyndham every step of the way. Don't want to take anything away from him, but he clearly was on the good side of the draw.
Yeah, and it ended up being, in terms of like stroke differential, it was about a half shot between the late early starters and the early late starters. It wasn't a huge difference. I think it was pretty obvious, though, that Wyndham Clark played the best in those conditions. And again, he really built his advantage, which was impressive because he was 2 shots ahead after the opening round, 4 shots ahead at the halfway point, 6 shots ahead as he headed into the final round. So he continued to grow the advantage, and he did so with some really tidy short game work. I want to go back to Saturday night because you and I were on the early live from on Sunday morning. There was a little bit of a foreboding sense, I think, for Wyndham Clark. And you were in there on Saturday night for his press conference. Wyndham Clark had bogeyed the 15th hole and his final hole. He missed about a 4-footer on his 54th hole of the tournament, sort of taking a little bit of the shine off what was a really gritty round of golf, including that eagle that he made on 16. He was disappointed. His sports psychologist, Julie Elion, told me that he was sending text messages like the angry face emoji, really trying to get over the disappointment of what he thought could have been an enormous lead heading into the final round of the U.S. Open. And look, it was already pretty historic. It was the third biggest lead, six shots at a U.S. Open that we'd seen since World War II. And yet there was still sort of this foreboding sense, Rex. Like, no player had ever coughed up that big of a lead in a U.S. Open. Six shots had been done before by Greg Norman in the 1996 Masters, losing to Nick Faldo, and Norman coughed up the lead by the time he walked off the 12th green there. You had the historical significance of Scottie Scheffler, who shot one of just two under par rounds in that third round, now going for the final leg of the career Grand Slam, and he was going to be going head-to-head against Wyndham Clark. And that, and what we talked about on Sunday morning was the sense that we knew it was going to be a really difficult spot for Wyndham. Some of that, I think, was obviously personality-based and the recent history of misbehavior that I'm sure we're going to get into. Some of that partly was because of Scottie Scheffler, enormously popular figure, a global superstar. Fans really like him. I also think, Rex, that there was a sense heading into the day that fans were going to turn on Wyndham Clark because they don't like blowouts. If they're paying a lot of money to come to a golf tournament, they want competition. They want it to be close. They want it to be tense. And they feel, perhaps with their presence, that they can make that felt. It was immediately recalling to me the 2023 U.S. Open and the exact situation where Wyndham Clark found himself as the underdog, overshadowed, going head-to-head in that final group with Ricky Fowler, with whom he was tied, with Rory McIlroy a shot behind. You and I both covered that U.S. Open in 2023. You and I obviously both covered this one. What do you think the differences were in sort of the atmosphere and certainly how Wyndham Clark handled it?
The biggest difference is one crowd was from Los Angeles and one was from the New York area. So I think that's pretty clear right from the start. And I don't want to jump too far ahead. And look, this is a larger conversation about crowd behavior, because on the very first tee box, a security official escorted two people off property. It started right from the get-go, and it was tough. You and I walked, we were inside the ropes for the first couple of holes, and they were cheering bad shots that were rolling off the green. They were clearly cheering for Scottie Scheffler, and you have to give Wyndham Clark credit. Same thing, you're right, happened to him at LACC, and I remember talking with his sports psychologist about this on Saturday night. The idea, he was paired with Ricky Fowler in the final round back in 2023. He knew he was not going to be the favorite in that pairing. And the game plan was, every time you hear something that's supporting for Ricky or maybe against you, turn that into a positive for you. Focus on your game. Focus on what you're trying to do. He had to do that, I would argue, probably times 10 today, because that was a tough walk for him. I'll go back to last year's Ryder Cup, and we talked a lot about the behavior at Bethpage. It was not that bad by any stretch of the imagination. Bethpage was next level. But I don't think I've ever seen this degree of, I don't know, dislike for someone.
I mean,
who
it was
on home soil.
It was animosity. It was vitriol. It was vicious. It was nasty. It was vocal. It was omnipresent. I mean, the security guard, as you mentioned, kicked out two folks on the first hole. He could have kicked out dozens.
That's the problem.
They could have kicked out hundreds over the course of the day. That's how prolific, that's how widespread the dislike for Wyndham Clark was in the final round. It was Ryder Cup-esque, it was President's Cup-esque, and yet you had an American who was trying to win the national championship of the U.S. Open. It was really incredible to see.
And I made this argument after the fact that, look, he was paired with Scottie Scheffler, the world number one. And you're right. Maybe they wanted to see, maybe the crowds wanted to see a little bit more of a closer competition. They did not want to see someone blowing someone out by seven strokes. I don't care who was sitting in that chair. I would argue that even if Rory McIlroy was paired with him in that final pairing, I'm pretty sure Wyndham Clark is still going to get heckled, because he is not a sympathetic figure, which is amazing to me. But he actually
became one, I think.
I think he did too. And that's kind of my point. I think if you really want to drill down into the story that is Wyndham Clark, if you want to look at that sort of the origin story and the career arc that he has gone through, if you pay attention, I think he should be a sympathetic figure because of everything that he has been through. Clearly, a talented player. And I'm not even taking away from his missteps, and he has owned those more than I possibly ever could. What he did last year at Oakmont,
he's
I don't know, owned
them recently. We should point out in the immediate aftermath, he kind of went into a bunker mentality and said this.
I think he was hiding. And you asked a good question about him tonight, with the idea being, how long did it take you to get over that? And he stretched it out, not days, but months. I mean, he went all the way to the Ryder Cup. Like, not making the Ryder Cup just sort of reinforced these feelings of probably negativity, reinforced these feelings of failure, everything that he had gone through last year. And it shows you how fragile a professional athlete can be, because yes, he missed the cut at Oakmont. Yes, he had high expectations coming in essentially as a quasi defending champion. I think every past champion looks at himself that way, even though he wasn't. However, sometimes you ebb and flow. Not every player is Tiger Woods. You're not going to be able to compete week in and week out. And he really beat himself up in that moment. He really allowed himself to let all of that weight crush him down. And the poor byproduct was he beat the crap out of a locker at Oakmont. And he kind of suffered those consequences. And I would argue recently, as you pointed out, he has owned that. He's answered this question dozens of times that you and I have heard. And now you look at what he has accomplished on the golf course. 5 PGA Tour victories, 2 major championships. Retief Goosen is in the Hall of Fame with pretty much that exact same resume. Retief Goosen had 8 wins in his PGA Tour career and 2 U.S. Opens. So a couple of years from now, we should be having this conversation about Wyndham Clark. And yet I walk away from watching him play golf today feeling sorry for him because of everything he endured from the crowd, because of how he handled himself. Because I don't know that there's a lot of players. I gave you this quote. You weren't in with Scottie Scheffler. But Scottie Scheffler's quote was, when he was asked about the crowds, is being in the arena is not for everyone. I don't think that was a knock against Wyndham Clark. As a matter of fact, I'm sure it wasn't a knock against Wyndham Clark. I think that was a nod to the idea of how difficult that actually was.
Yeah, for those of us who are not in the arena, I don't think we can possibly imagine what the psychological abuse would be like to deal with that for 4, 5, 6 hours throughout the course of a round, trying to win a major championship. It is an incredible full circle 1 year moment for Wyndham Clark, who again a year ago at Oakmont was trashing his locker, and there was a couple other missteps as well over the line over the past couple of years, whether he was decapitating his driver at Quail Hollow at the PGA Championship. He said that Rex, he really fell into a dark place following Oakmont. He felt like his world ranking, he felt like his game, he felt like his reputation was all dwindling and getting to a point where he didn't even know how he could recover it. You look at what happened over the following couple of months. He made a couple of changes. He ended up hiring a swing coach because he felt like he was so lost with his game. He made a caddy change a couple of months ago as well. He got into a new relationship. He parted ways at least briefly with his sports psychologist. So this was a player who was really trying to find himself and to dig himself out of a pretty nasty hole. How he did that, I think, is still a little bit of a mystery. He said he sort of cocooned himself with his team and just needed time to get through it. And I think what you saw on Sunday and a little bit over the weekend on Saturday as well was a player who had braced himself for the adversity that he was going to face. And when we talked to sports psychologist Julie Elion on Sunday, she said they've been training for adversity. They knew it was going to be bad. They knew it was going to harken back to what happened in 2023 with the Ricky Rory dynamic as well. I think the vitriol surprised even them. It certainly surprised Julie. She was walking with Wyndham Clark's group. She said it was so bad. She walked in on the 8th hole and needed to go talk to somebody because she was so emotional at seeing someone she cares about so deeply who was inundated with such abuse from the fans. But they had a strategy for the day. Anytime you hear something, turn it into a positive. They told them not to look around. Don't let them get into your peripheral vision. Don't take anything that they say personally. Just sort of focus on the task at hand. Back in 2023, every time you heard that, it was sort of a rallying cry. And it was a reminder to him to, quote, be cocky and to show them who he was. At that time, he was just a one-time PGA Tour winner. I think that was a very successful way to look at it. 2026, I mean, this was all-out war to the point that Wyndham Clark afterward even told the fans in his acceptance speech, I know you guys did not want me to win, but the fact that he endured all that abuse, the fact that he heard all that vitriol, the fact that he had a 6-shot lead and again was fighting against history and no player ever in the U.S. Open squandering that big of an advantage, for him to survive all that in that atmosphere, while paired with the world number one, I think this should really help him feel bulletproof and certainly have validation for all of the things that he and Julie Ellion are working on to fortify what, again, had been some self-doubt over the course of his career.
I think two things. One, we can't question his talent ever again. You win two U.S. Open.
Amazing golfer.
He was able to do it on two vastly different golf shots. I mean, physically, he's able to do everything on the golf course you need to do to be a world-class player. To your point now, I don't think you can question his mental toughness. I don't think anybody's ever going to question his mental toughness because I don't know many players that would have to go through what he went through today. And it opens up, and I don't want to go too far down this path because we've done it before, and I don't think you particularly like the conversation. But I always come back to the idea that every time we end up in a situation like this with a fan step over the line, last year at Bethpage, this time, it always seems to be New York. However, I always kind of marvel at the pearl clutching because we talk all the time. Brian Rolapp in 2 days is going to really talk about trying to get golf, professional golf, as a mainstream sport. And every time we have that conversation, the one part we leave out is this is fan behavior in mainstream sports. This is what happens at Yankee Stadium or Madison Square Garden or any other professional arena. The players cannot be coddled. They cannot be protected. I have nothing but respect for the security guards who were out walking today. However, to your point, they could have kicked almost everybody off that golf course if they were really trying to wade their way through, and that's impossible. Again, nothing close to what we saw at Bethpage, but it was really, really bad. And I'm not sitting here trying to justify it at all. I'm simply saying that this is mainstream sports. And sometimes I think golf has a hard time looking in the mirror and really asking the hard question, do we want to be a mainstream sport?
And look, that was Wyndham Clark. He knew it. He embraced it. He knew this was part of sports and rooting for and against certain players, certain teams, whatever the case may be. He even made the remark in his post-round press conference, Rex, like, this was nice to win an away game, knowing that he was the underdog, knowing that no one really wanted
him. He's American.
I know. It is an interesting conversation, though, of does this close the chapter on what has been a tumultuous period of Wyndham Clark's career? Now that he's won a major championship, now that he was able to sort of weather this storm that he had on the weekend at Shinnecock Hills with, again, all of the abuse that was rained down on him, according to Wyndham Clark, he thinks he does. He says, hopefully this closes the chapter. Hopefully I can win you guys over eventually. Do you think that this victory, this moment, the way that he did it, the manner in which he did so, do you think that this can finally bring some closure and we can all move on with our lives, and all of a sudden Wyndham Clark's reputation is not permanently stained?
I think some closure. Absolutely. I think some fans will probably look at this performance and realize, identify it for what it was, a very gutsy performance by a player that you should probably go out and cheer for. And I'm going to say the same thing I think we said on Sunday night's podcast when he kind of came close in Canada and he didn't get there. And I think you and I both sort of batted around the idea that maybe he's a villain. Maybe he likes the idea.
He doesn't want to be. Quote, I don't want to be the heel of the PGA Tour.
And I understand that. And there are those, and I always go back to Patrick Reed, maybe unfairly, but there are plenty of players that are okay with that. They're okay with the idea that, sure, come at me. I'll have fun with this. I'll absolutely enjoy this. We've seen it time and time again from top players from Europe when they come over here to play the Ryder Cup and Americans when they go overseas. It is interesting to me that through everything he has been through, he doesn't want to be that guy. And yet, last week in Canada, this is what brought the conversation up, he had no problem putting the American jersey on because he thought it was playful. He didn't realize that it was going to get this reaction from the crowd. So I think, to answer your question, some people are going to be swayed by this. Some people are going to realize that very talented guy, maybe a little bit on the emotional side, and maybe makes decisions that aren't the best from time to time, but worth cheering for. Others, however, are probably going to look at what happened last week in Canada and think to themselves, this guy wants the heat. This guy wants the shade. I'm going to give it to him.
Yeah, he wants the smoke. It's not been the first time. It's not going to be the last time that he has put his golf shoe in his mouth. He's made several controversial comments, none more so, I think, than a couple months ago. We're sitting here on Father's Day when he was at the Masters Par 3 contest, and he said at an open mic, this is the greatest form of birth control, seeing all the kids roll around. Like, those are the sort of moments, those are the sort of comments that Wyndham Clark might be prone to saying. Honestly, I think that makes him human. I think that makes him complex. I think that makes him layered. That is why we watch sports. That is why we invest all of our time and energy into covering these athletes. He's an interesting guy. I don't think his talent, certainly his toughness, can be in doubt any longer. Let's talk a little bit, Rex, about the actual final round that Wyndham Clark put together. Because keep in mind, he was three over at the turn. Which shot specifically do you think really he won in this golf tournament? Because there's a couple times throughout the round that it could have gone either way.
There was a couple shots from the rough where it seemed as if he was dead. And I'm going to go to 18 because that's the one that immediately comes to mind. Because that shot could have gone wrong really, really quickly. He could have ended up in a terrible spot and not had a chance to get up and down for bogey. That's what Shinnecock Hills does for you. You don't have to hit that bad of a shot to put yourself just in an impossible position where you can't make par in that situation. And we're staring at a playoff. That was a tough shot. It was 192 yards. I think he said it was like 165 to the front edge. Felt like he was going to get a flyer. He'd had plenty of those throughout the course of the week. I will say that there is something to be said if you're going to miss a bunch of fairways. Eventually, you do figure out how to play from that stuff. And that's what it seemed like he and his caddy had done, where, hey, look, we had this a couple holes ago. Maybe it's going to fly. Maybe it's not going to fly. But he had a couple of those over the course of the day where it seems as if he'd finally put himself in an impossible position, and he always found a way to climb out of it.
I mean, there were some really, really bad shots that Wyndham Clark, the winner of the 126 U.S. Open, hit over the weekend. I'm thinking back to the eighth hole where he dumped a wedge short and right in the third round, ended up making bogey. I'm thinking back to the 15th hole, another wedge where he spun it off the front edge, couldn't get up and down. I'm thinking about the 4-foot miss that he had on 18 that he could have had a 7-shot lead going into the final round. Even in the final round, Rex, I think of some of the really poor shots that he hit. Par 3 second hole, missing way short and left. I'm thinking about the fifth hole, going long over the back of position. That should have been dead. What is the one thing, Rex, you can't do in that position? You can't leave it short. Instead, he ends up making a bogey on what was the easiest hole on the golf course. In fact, Wyndham Clark bogeyed two of the three easiest holes on the golf course in that final round. And yet, even though he hit shots that were really frustrating to him, and you could see him like grabbing his face and getting frustrated and trying to not let that shot linger, Wyndham Clark still had so many heroic shots as well that he was able to offset it. Whether it was the 5-iron that he had in the fifth hole on Saturday, whether it was the 7-iron that he had in the 14th hole on Saturday, whether it was the 3-wood that he had in the 16th hole to make the only eagle of the week on 16. In the final round in particular, there was a couple shots that I really think won him this golf tournament. Number one, hit a great drive down 10, actually took driver trying to bust it as far as possible. What did he have? About 75 yards from that position. Really tricky shot. It's really tight. And if you chunk it a little bit, that's rolling back down to your feet. If you bone a little bit, it's going over the back, and all of a sudden 5 or 6 comes into play. To hit the shot that he did from that lie downwind, zipping it back to 4 feet, I thought was super impressive. Obviously, you mentioned the tee shot on 16 that went way left, was able to clear the bunker with his second shot. The putt that he made, I was standing right there. The degree of difficulty on that putt, and he never talked about it afterward, was incredible. Going up a slope right in front of him, back down the slope. If that putt misses, it's with the wrong speed, all of a sudden he's got 5 or 6 feet coming back up the hill again on Poa greens that are really bumpy, a lot of foot traffic, and he had about a 15-20 mile crosswind to deal with again. So he only made 2 birdies, Wyndham Clark did, in his final round of 73. Those two shots on 10 and 16 won him the golf tournament.
And I think to that point, I just pointed out his strokes gained stats, his tee to green stats for the week. He finished fourth. So it's not as though he hit the ball terribly in relation to the rest of the field. It's his approach play that surprises me a little bit. He was clearly middle of the pack. And we talked endlessly. You and I talked about this. Brandel Chamblee, Paul McGinley, everybody who analyzed this golf course said it's a second shot golf course. You need to be able to control your irons. It's why all of us leaned into Scottie Scheffler. It's why all of us thought that, yes, it's absolutely perfect for him. The one thing that we all said you had to do, he didn't really do that all that well, but he made up for it with his tee play. He was great off the tee. He really didn't put himself in any terrible positions. Even when he missed a fairway, it seems like he had a way to battle his way out of it. And his putting was phenomenal. I think the one that stood out through two rounds, and you and I both leaned into it, 214 feet of putts through two rounds, two difficult rounds on a really hard golf course. Those are the two things that won it for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been the sort of the hallmark of Wyndham Clark's last couple months in the PGA Tour as well. Won at the Nelson on the strength of a hot putter, nearly won the Memorial, nearly won Canada, and now wins the U.S. Open for his second title. Some of the other protagonists, Rex, as it relates to that final round, obviously Scottie Scheffler gave it a good run, ended up shooting 71, one over par, dropped down to a tie for fourth. We're going to talk about him a little bit later in the Love It or Lav It segment. Let's talk a little bit about Sam Burns, who is the closest pursuer, had some opportunities. You said he was emotional on Sunday. How come?
Asked about his dad. His dad was there. And I don't think, if you've watched Sam Burns throughout the course of his career, talented player, ultra-talented player, best putter on the PGA Tour, I think statistically, and anyone who has two eyes will tell you, yes, he is the best putter on the PGA Tour, which is what was so shocking to me. I did not feel like he ever really put pressure on Wyndham. I feel like the pressure that Wyndham felt was self-imposed. He was doing that to himself. I don't think he ever looked up at the leaderboard and thought, yes, Sam Burns got off to a great start. And he did. I don't think that factored in at all. The part that gets me is when he finally had a chance to tie for the lead, and he was one or two back for almost the entire day. It was on 17 when he had like a 10-footer coming up the hill. Aren't easy greens to putt, but probably the worst putt I've ever seen Sam Burns hit in his life. 18, he's got an opportunity to tie him. He's just one stroke back. Gave it a good run, didn't drop. The one thing that Sam Burns needed to do coming down the stretch, he wasn't able to do. But I will say, when you start the day seven strokes back and you still have an opportunity to win on the 18th green, you have to do the golf clap, right? You have to just tip your cap, be like, you gave it a good run.
I mean, he shot 67.
You point out what happened last year, and we would have taken a deep dive on what happened to him last year at Oakmont when he did not get the ruling. Clearly, he was in casual water. Clearly, he should have gotten the ruling. It really probably would have changed the outcome of that championship. Imagine a year later being able to right what was a ruling wrong. Wasn't able to do that, but still could have been a very cool story.
I mean, that's the inverse of the Wyndham Clark story, isn't it? Here's a player who got absolutely hosed in what was some pretty nasty weather late Sunday at Oakmont with all the standing water, shoots a million, ends up, I think, really comporting himself well, took responsibility, didn't dodge the media afterward. I came away very impressed by Sam Burns. I came away impressed by this performance as well. Really gave himself an opportunity, was 4 under for his first 8 holes on Sunday to make a charge up the leaderboard, put his name up there, certainly scare Wyndham Clark a little bit, just knowing that was going to be a low number in the clubhouse. Yeah, one of the best putters in the world is certainly going to rue what happened over the final hour of the golf tournament. The 3-putt on 15, including a miss from 4 feet, actually did well the hole, about an 18-footer on 16, but the miss on 17, had about a 17-footer on 18 as well, and was unable to get a drop. Still a 67 on a day when I think the conditions were a little bit trickier weather-wise than I think even certainly Thorgard in the meteorologist's office was anticipating. Sam Burns' time is coming. He is such a better, more well-rounded player than he was a couple years ago, particularly with his iron play. That was really the missing link for Sam Burns. The way that he has shored that up in 2026, he's been red hot now for a month or two. I like the way that his game is trending. If it doesn't come at the Open Championship, I think you have to believe that Sam Burns, major champion, is right around the corner. All right, that is a wrap for the final round of the 126 US Open. But after the break, we're going to be doing a Love It or Lav It segment, talking about the setup for the USGA, talking about Shinnecock as a venue, the rollback, Scottie Scheffler, so much more to get into. Stay with us. All right, Rex, it's time for another edition of Love It or Lav It. If you're new here, first of all, welcome. But the rules of the game are you either love something or you lav it, you hate on it, you don't like it. Let's start with
You're a curmudgeon, yes. We've established that, yes.
Exactly. Let's first of all start with the USGA setup. It was a talking point all week long, even before we got to the golf tournament, just pretty much based on what happened in 2004 and 2018 when the USGA admittedly lost the golf course and did not stick to their ideals. So after we saw how it all played out, this 126 US Open, do you love or lav what the USGA did in terms of the setup?
I love that one of the best parts of the week, and look, Sunday with Wyndham Clark winning is always the best part of the week, but John Bodenhammer, who is the top setup man for the USGA, on Wednesday's press conference, I thought he was going to pass out when he was talking through what he was going to do with the golf course. I thought he was going to break into hives. I thought he was going to implode like, you know, the devil does when they talk about
softer, slower. He was literally pained while saying these words.
I mean, his eyes would shut and he'd shake his head and Mike Wan, the CEO of the USGA, would laugh because he thinks it's funny and likes to rub it. And he nailed it. I don't think there's any other way of saying it. When you have every player that comes off the golf course, Scottie Scheffler said it, Sam Burns said it, Wyndham Clark said it, Keith Mitchell said it, every player that walked off the golf course said, yeah, it was slow. It was soft. It was a lot slower and softer than we thought it was going to be. They had to do that. Had they not done that, you and I would not be sitting here right now doing the podcast. And you and I both know this. They would have had to stop play for sure on Thursday. And again, probably on Saturday morning when it came through again and we had gusts to 40 miles an hour. You cannot play golf on any golf course that's with 40 mile an hour winds that's not set up to endure that. And that's what they do so well, the RNA, at the Open Championship. It's taken a while, I think, for the USGA to come around with the idea that we have to do this to finish this golf tournament, to make this a fair golf tournament. And I'll go back to just the obvious. On Saturday night, there was five players who were under par for the week with a grand total combined of 11 under par. We finished up the week with three players under par with a grand total, I think I did the math, of eight under par. That's a really good outcome for a golf course that was clearly set up to endure what were crazy conditions.
Yeah, and look, I don't even want to get into how many players were under par. You look historically at Shinnecock, it's been three players all time who finished under par. So I think the fact that we even had three was indicative of a slower, softer golf course. Like, I couldn't believe my eyes, Rex. This was a masterpiece from start to finish for the USGA. And the reason I can't believe my eyes is because we've become so accustomed to bashing the USGA and bashing their setup and second-guessing them and wondering exactly what they were doing. John Bodenhammer, Jeff Hall. I mean, this was a masterpiece in setup. Erring on the side of caution, doing so correctly, setting up the golf course, yes, to promote decent scoring, but also to not embarrass the best players. There was never any sort of doubt that they weren't going to be able to get in the round with the conditions that were presented. And even on Saturday, when you did have those violent winds, I think what was the highest gust, like 47, 48 miles an hour, the morning wave got absolutely hammered. But Rex, as the wind tapered down, the setup that the USGA had, I thought, was impeccable, because even as the wind tapered off, the golf course got increasingly firm, increasingly browned out, increasingly crusty. And so the difficulty and the challenge increased as the wind and that challenge decreased. It was a perfect marriage from start to finish. Kudos to the USGA for one of the best setups that I can imagine and certainly that I can remember in a US Open. How about, Rex, Shinnecock Hills as a venue? We've grown accustomed to this, at least this century, 04 and 2018. This is the first time we've been here in 8 years. Do you like it or do you love it as a US Open venue?
I love it. And the reason is it's an amazing golf course with so much history. And I think this part of Long Island is a very special place. You and I were driving home this afternoon, and as difficult as this week is, and I'm not even saying for us, just generally, this is a difficult week logistically. It's hard for people to get here. It's hard for people to leave. It's sort of in the middle of nowhere. It was very dusty. It was a very dry week. Leaving, you realize how special this place is. It was a very good championship with a very good champion, but just the gravity of being here, which at a golf course that is part of the fabric of American golf. And I don't get very sappy about those types of things very often, but it's special. It's right next to National Golf Links. It's in a very cool part of the world. Yes, I love this golf course. Logistically, it's always going to be difficult. And I know this is going to circle back around, and the folks from Newtown Square are
hello, Newtown Square. Yes, it's Rex Hoggard again.
I know this is not going to age well, but this needs to be in the rotation. I would never make the same argument about this golf course that I would about Aronimink. And I know that doesn't sound fair, but this golf course is part of American golf. It needs to host a U.S. Open once every decade seems fair. But I just think it's so special.
It's a cathedral, might be the best golf course in America. In my opinion, it's certainly the best golf course that hosts a championship of this caliber, the best in the U.S. Open, wrote it. It does have some challenges. And look, Mike Wan, the CEO of the USGA, left millions of dollars on the table by having the U.S. Open at Shinnecock. However, to the USGA, it's worth it to have it at this golf course, because if that's the sort of the prestige and the caliber of golf course as it is. Can you have six or seven of these in the U.S. Open Rota? Can this be a fixture? Could this be a potential anchor site? No, that's just bad business. But to have a Shinnecock, to have a Riviera, and have a Marion, but to balance it out with some of those big ticket venues, if you're thinking like a Pebble Beach or an Oakmont or a Pinehurst. To me, that's the perfect sort of mix and blend where the USGA can still go big business and you can still get hundreds of thousands of people pouring through the gates. And look, there's a lot of folks who are pointing out how dead the atmosphere seemed on Saturday and Sunday. To me, this was the USGA right-sizing their championship. To me, it was still plenty loud. It still had a pretty tense vibe. It was probably best, I think, for a spectator experience to be able to get up close and personal with the players and not feel like you're fighting 50,000 to 75,000 fans each and every day. It's a great mix that the USGA has. Kudos. I love Shinnecock, and I am unapologetic about it. All right, Scottie Scheffler was in that final group with Wyndham Clark trying to knock off, again, the final leg of the career Grand Slam, shot 71. So as we look forward now, Rex, to 2027 and beyond, do you love or lab the idea that Scottie is going to need three or more attempts to complete the career Grand Slam again?
I love that idea, and this has nothing to do with Scottie Scheffler. Clearly, he's the world number one. He's a talented player.
We're going to be doing this deep into the 2030s.
I believe because I think this is a perfect indication of how hard it is to win one of these events. And when you look at what Rory had to go through to win the Masters, and look, Scottie did a really good job this week of deflecting all of the career Grand Slam talk about trying to keep it about the golf. He didn't want to talk about his birthday. He didn't want to talk about the career Grand Slam. He didn't want to talk about Father's Day. I know there's a lot going on Sunday. I don't want to get into any of it. He did a great job, but the fact of the matter, that's always in the back of your mind. He only needs to talk to Rory about this, about how difficult it is to get over that hump. Eventually, he gets there. I truly believe that. I think he gets to that career Grand Slam sooner rather than later. But I do think it takes a couple more tries because it's so hard to do this. He played well all week long. Again, stumbled a little bit out of the gates. Didn't play great on Thursday, and that's probably what ended up costing him the championship. But by and large, he was doing all the things that Scottie Scheffler needs to do, and he just wasn't able to overcome that start. He wasn't able to overcome what Wyndham Clark was able to do coming down the stretch. And it's just going to take a couple of times because eventually he's going to fall onto the right golf course, get off to the right start, and have the right opponents.
If you're looking at the next five venues for the U.S. Opens, Pebble Beach next year, followed by Wingfoot, Pinehurst, Marion, and Riviera. Pebble Beach, obviously, he plays it each and every year on the PGA Tour. It's a signature event. Has not quite won there yet. Another golf course that has POA greens that can be very difficult to putt. I think I'm going to lab this idea because I'm circling Wingfoot as an opportunity for him to do so. Already has experience playing there in 2020. Pinehurst, for whatever reason, perhaps the preparation, having just played, I think it was the Memorial the week before in 2024. He's going to have a different preparation that time. But again, Donald Ross greens a little bit tricky as well. So I think Wingfoot is a possibility and a good possibility for Scottie Scheffler to knock off the final leg of the slam in 2028. How about this one, Rex, with Joaquin Niemann, who is the only player seemingly to run afoul of the code of conduct policy, which has been sort of under renewed importance and emphasis for the major championships. This year was Joaquin Niemann, who was dinged with two shots for chucking a club anywhere from 50 to 75 yards. Based on reports, Joaquin Niemann actually said he was quite proud of how far his club traveled. Potentially a future javelin thrower is Joaquin Niemann. Joaquin did finish, Rex, in a tie for seventh. So he actually earned a return invite to the U.S. Open next year, which is important because this year he got in through the small, narrow pathway for LIV Golf being the top points earner. But are you loving or laving seemingly the USGA singling out Joaquin Niemann for his club toss in the opening round?
Laving it. And I think you and I were pretty clear on the podcast on Wednesday night. And I don't think we're on
not
the right
be
side.
More clear.
I think you and I are probably on the right wrong side of history on this one, based on Brandel Chamblee and Paul McGinley, who were on the vast other side saying that, of course, this is a long time coming, that the governing bodies should crack down on this poor behavior. I'm not here to defend Joaquin Niemann or any of the other petulant players who decide to throw clubs or to drop F-bombs or to berate an official or whatever the case may be. I'm not here for that at all. What I'm defending is we still don't know exactly what happened on that sixth hole in the dark on Thursday night when they were finishing up play. He threw his club. That's all we know. He kicked at some grass, apparently, according to some reporting, that really good reporting that was in The Athletic. But I still don't get how this was so egregious that we skipped past what should have been a warning to a two-stroke penalty. That's as tough as you could possibly be as a rulemaker to give out a two-stroke penalty, knowing what we know. that going back to the Masters, this is the first event that used this new formula. We did see what Sergio Garcia did at the Masters. We saw him destroy his club against a cooler and try to destroy a tee marker. And somehow that was just a ruling. So I'm trying to wrap my mind around how whatever it is that Joaquin did that suddenly got him into this position. It seemed like the punishment just did not fit the crime.
Yeah, it was certainly excessive. And the language in the rule is so vague and so subjective that this is just going to open up so many other issues. You're talking about, quote, unacceptable behavior. You're talking about abuse of a club or a golf course. I promise you that Joaquin Neiman was not the only player in the field of 156 players on Thursday.
We have video of John Rahm kicking his driver down the fairway.
Yeah, like same so, day. So that's a perfect example. So John Rahm, did he kick his driver or was he just sort of kicking it like a soccer ball down and he didn't really mean it? So like, so where are you going to draw the line? The number of players who I'm sure were stringing F-bombs after bad shots. Again, on a day, on Thursday, when the winds were gusting upwards of 30 to 35 miles an hour. And the best score in the clubhouse at the time that Joaquin Neiman was on the golf course was a 68. It's brutally difficult. Yes, I understand it. And these are players in the arena, and they should really understand the importance of composing yourself and having poise in the golf course. I do think poise is a skill. However, if you are enforcing these rules as a terms of a code of conduct policy, it is so subjective. So if you want to get rid of club tossing, just say you're getting rid of club tossing. But all of a sudden, you can't be playing God. And you can't be policing each and every club throw. This one only went 25 yards. This one went 50 yards. This one only went 5 yards. It's not bad. This one was accompanied by a club stand. This one was accompanied by an F-bomb. Like, just drop it. It's too subjective. Yes, you're going to say you know it when you see it. We haven't seen it. There was no video evidence. We're just taking the word of a volunteer. Well, again, with no video evidence suggests good for Joaquin Neiman finishing in the top seven and earning a return trip next year. Final topic for Love It or Lav It, the golf ball rollback, which the USGA and RNA said they're going to be punting until 2030. Are you loving or laving the idea that the governing bodies are taking a step back and now collaborating with the big tours?
I'm loving it because I think we established and through various reporting and through various conversations that what they were trying to do by rolling back the golf ball wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to achieve what they were trying to get, which is essentially rolling back. They were trying to find a way to bring the game's best players back a little bit. Not only do we know that that wasn't going to happen, but Cameron Young, being the primary example, is actually hitting the ball further this year using a golf ball that would be deemed conforming under these new standards. So instead of just forging ahead with a policy that wasn't going to work, I will give the USGA and the RNA credit for at least taking a pause and listening to everyone in the game and deciding that let's come up with something that's more comprehensive. I'm not on the fence saying that something doesn't need to be done. Yes, there probably is something need to be done at the elite level to make sure that golf courses like this golf course is always relevant, that we can always go back to this for a national championship. This wasn't going to do it, and now we have time to sit back and try to come up with a way to create a program that will do it.
Yeah, that's a good argument, and that's why I will love it as well. I do think it's an embarrassment for the governing bodies that they basically spent a decade working on this rule, and it turns out, as we're now a year and a half from when the rollback was supposed to be implemented, that it doesn't actually work. I'm still skeptical that we can reach a point, even though Mike Wan, CEO of the USGA, wants there to be a sense of urgency that we can get to a solution that'll work for everybody. We'd love to see them target the club head to make center strike hits more important. Love to see them target the golf driver shaft as well. That alone, knocking out a couple of inches, will knock off 10, 20 yards. All right, that is a wrap for Love It or Lav It. Coming up after this short break, we'll have final thoughts from the week of the U.S. Open, looking ahead to what should be a busy week on the PGA Tour. All right, Rex, another major championship down with the U.S. Open, but a potentially monumental week for the PGA Tour looms. You and I are both going to be in Cromwell, Connecticut for the Travelers Championship, where the CEO of the PGA Tour, Brian Rolapp, is expected to meet with the media on Tuesday, in which he's expected to unveil some changes to the future competition model, because the PGA Tour Policy Board is meeting and voting on Monday, the day that we are recording this podcast. What are you expecting, and what should golf fans be prepping for?
That meeting is from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Monday. It gives you an idea of everything they have to cover. So there's going to be a lot going on in there. And it's impossible to sit here and say exactly what you and I are going to be reporting on Tuesday, because I still think there's some things in the air. It was funny. I was talking with Keith Mitchell, who's on the policy board. He had a really good finish, tied for fourth at the U.S. Open. And I asked him, do you think you're going to get into Travelers? And he shrugged and he goes, got to be there anyway all day Monday, because he's on the policy board. And you get an idea of how intense these negotiations have been. I think it will be a general outline of what we can expect starting in 2028 and going forward. The track systems that we talked about, sort of expanding the signature events, turning the track two events into, using Rory McIlroy's phrase, not mine, glorified Korn Ferry Tour events. All of those things. Yes, all of those things that we sort of touched on. I don't think we're going to have, we're not going to be able to drill down into specifics, but we'll have some general ideas.
Yeah, and look, Brian Roelof met with the media at the Players Championship, where he sort of looked ahead to the Travelers, looked ahead 3 months down the line, and said, I should have a more concrete update. Again, I don't think we're going to be slotting tournaments and that this is what's going to look like in 2028. What I'm hoping that we're going to get a general sense of are, here are the tweaks we're going to make for the 2027 competition model that the future competition committee has been working on since the Tour Championship, and also just sort of laying a groundwork, a blueprint, a formula for what the PGA Tour should look like. And I think most importantly, why they're doing it. Why should fans be invested in this track one model? Perhaps even more importantly, why should fans be paying attention to this track two model and the tournaments that potentially are going to be running concurrently to the PGA Tour? It's a new look for the PGA Tour. It's what Brian Roelof has been sort of previewing over the past year, ever since he got in office at the PGA Tour. It's going to be a very eventful week. You and I are both going to be there reporting for Golf Central. I'll be there the entire week. You'll be flying back home midweek. We'll have more golfchannel.com. We'll have more on as well, the midweek podcast, and we'll certainly be on YouTube. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Thanks so much for paying attention to all of us, all of our content about the Live From week, golfchannel.com, as well as the Live From newsletter with Rex and Lav, will be dropping on Monday morning in your inboxes as well. It's been a great week here in Shinnecock, and already looking forward to Birkdale, the Open Championship.